This is Greater LA on KCRW. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chitakis. Welcome to you.
You want another bag?
Sure.
There you go.
We're at the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where Laura Balick just sold another few pounds of tomatoes.
Alrighty, you're going to be at $17.85 altogether.
She and her husband, Scott, run a four-acre farm in Fillmore. They mostly grow tomatoes and sell almost all of them at farmers markets, just like this one.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You have a great day.
You too.
As the drought drags on, the future of water-loving crops like tomatoes hangs in the balance. That's why your ketchup and tomato sauce cost about 10% more than it did last year. But the Balicks use a fraction of the water that outdoor tomatoes use, and they grow them year-round because they grow them in a greenhouse. The drought really isn't affecting them.
We definitely use minimal water. There's a lot less waste. That's not necessarily an issue we have. Although, in general, water and lack of water is a huge thing for markets in general, because we do see a lot of farmers that are dropping out of markets.
Using less water while growing more tomatoes. Well, that's good news for the planet. It's good news for the grocery bill. So why isn't every tomato farmer doing it? Here's KCRW's Kaylee Wells.
The Balicks grow tomatoes without soil, so all the water goes directly into the plant roots. This method of farming is called hydroponics.
True hydroponics is solely water. Instead of you do, long soaks in your garden, and how much of that water stays at your plant's roots? It doesn't. You lose a lot. So it is more efficient in that sense.
Back at the farm, Scott Balick walks between rows of tomato vines. They climb wires strung between the beams of the greenhouse. Their stunted roots are submerged in little bags. He reaches down and pulls out a water dropper.
We're pretty precise. Our drippers are pressure compensated, and they're literally putting out half a gallon per hour.
Which is less than 10% of what you'd need to water tomatoes in the field. That's a pretty attractive setup in drought-ridden California. An app on Balick's phone tells him the moisture level of the plants, and he monitors exactly what nutrients get laced into the water the plants receive. He's literally got it down to a science.
Because it's not like the roots can go down in the ground and access molybdenum and boron and copper and zinc. Those are those micro elements that are normally in the ground. Our water doesn't have that. Every single nutrient that a tomato plant needs, we've added to the water.
When his grandfather started the farm back in the 70s, it was a pretty radical idea, growing without soil. Now, about a third of fresh tomatoes grown domestically and then sold at a grocery store or a farmer's market are grown like this. But actually, that does not account for the bulk of the tomatoes grown here in California. Most of our tomato crops are processing tomatoes, meaning they get canned, bottled, and jarred into soups, ketchups, and salsas. And in that sector, hydroponics isn't catching on at all. Because, yeah, water is pricey in California, but you know what's always been even more expensive? Labor, says agricultural economist Dan Sumner.
If the water price doubles, it raises the cost of production by 5%. Not because the water's cheap for them, but because the labor and the capital of a greenhouse, for example, is so much more than the water cost is.
Big companies growing processing tomatoes have machines that can pick for them outside, so they have lower labor costs. But if they were to move the tomatoes inside and use hydroponics, they'd have to pay for people to pick them, and people are more expensive than machines. So water shortages aren't their biggest problem now. Still, Sumner says over time, profitable farming in California will get harder. He says we're already seeing crops that need more water and make less money leave California.
As climate change progresses, we've cut way back in the amount of hay. We've cut way back in the amount of corn silage fed to dairy cows.
But he says tomatoes are safe for now.
There's a ways to go on those crops before we, check off the boxes and get down to processing tomatoes.
And if ever it does get to that point, the tomatoes likely won't move to greenhouses. They'll move to somewhere like Mexico, where labor is cheaper.
I don't envision, and I haven't heard anyone talk about a period of time in which we'd grow indoor tomatoes in California for processing. It's much more likely that they might be grown somewhere else, some other part of the world.
Hydroponics has the best chance of catching on with the small local farms where big machines and international relocation aren't really an option. Scott Balick says it's more affordable for him to grow that way. While his outdoor competitors drop off in the fall, he keeps making money all winter long.
In a way, it balances out. We're able to grow 365 days. With that, you know, we're getting more crops. In the field, you're only going to do maybe one a year because it's seasoned. It's based on the season.
And as the technology gets better, the produce from his greenhouse tastes just as good as the outdoor-grown organic tomato a few stalls down at the farmer's market. Because, yes, hydroponics are catching on, but they don't make financial sense for all growers. That competing tomato was from Sunrise Organics in Santa Barbara, where hydroponics still don't pencil out. Samantha Watson with Sunrise Organics points out that greenhouses are a big investment.
At the size that we are, they're very expensive. We deal with a lot of wind in our community as well. So, like, you could spend days building them, pay your whole crew, and then you get a bad wind, and you're like, well, there goes the greenhouses.
The vine-ripe tomatoes from Balick Farms and Sunrise Organics cost about $4 per pound at the farmer's market. For context, your local Ralph's is probably selling them for about half that much. That price comes with its own set of downsides. Tomatoes that travel farther just don't taste as good. Just ask Dave Freed, better known by the local tomato enthusiast community as Dave the Tomato Guy. He's become a local expert who travels to gardening groups and blogs about how to achieve vine-ripe perfection. He says the less flavorful supermarket tomatoes get picked before they turn red, so they last longer.
And that's why most of the time we complain about it. They're just not that great. But on the other hand, if we wanted vine-ripe tomatoes, we'd have to pay a great deal more because they're not going to last very long on a shelf.
If we want to maintain a cheaper grocery store tomato, it could mean losing taste and local water and local jobs, unless we're willing to pay a premium for a local, drought-tolerant tomato. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Coming up, how a small team of psychiatrists is trying to make a big difference in the lives of people with mental illness. Is it big enough, though? That's yours on Greater LA, right after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thousands of people with mental illness are experiencing chronic homelessness in Los Angeles. But if you're living on the street, you probably don't have access to regular, high-quality psychiatric care. A new street psychiatry program from the LA County Department of Mental Health wants to change that by meeting unhoused people right where they are. The program embeds psychiatric professionals with LA County's existing outreach teams, allowing them to do visits and tests in the field, administer medication, provide follow-up care to folks suffering from untreated mental illness. The still-growing initiative is slated to be the most robust street psychiatry program in the nation. And LA's first street psychiatrist, Dr. Cheyenne Rabb, joins us today to talk about his work. Also here, by the way, is journalist Doug Smith, who wrote about the program for the LA Times. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Rabb, I want to start with you. You were put in charge of assembling this street psychiatry group a few years back. It's heartbreaking to see people who are obviously in distress on the streets, who seemingly don't have anywhere else to go. How do you identify who needs help and how to get the best help for that person?
So when it comes to identifying who needs help, part of it is clinical education, training to be a doctor, and having the skill set needed to identify symptoms of mental illness. And in addition to having that skill set, part of it in the field is also we work, you know, street psychiatry is not an isolated field. It is a team-based approach with many different individuals working together to help the most vulnerable members of our communities. So there's a referral process, there's experts in outreach and social work who are identifying those that need completing clinical assessment tools to identify what the vulnerability index is, and then pulling me in once the patients are appropriately identified to make sure this is congruent with my clinical training and everything is matching up and this person truly needs our help.
You hear about, you know, obviously the travails of people on the streets who don't have anywhere to go. A lot of it because of mental illness, but also some of it is mental illness that happens from being on the street. Can you delineate between the two? I mean, how do you know where the problems are and how rooted they are?
When it comes to severe mental illness in particular, you know, if you have a thought disorder, something like schizophrenia, or if you have a mood disorder, something like bipolar disorder, the way the brain is processing information and interpreting information from the environment is a little bit different. Because of that, it can be difficult to rationally navigate resources, break away from social relationships, community support structures, and the risk for homelessness starts to increase because the way you're processing information is not the way it should be, or at least not rationally grounded in reality sometimes. And therefore, the risk for homelessness is very high. Now, that being said, once homelessness sets in, it's a very bad prognostic indicator because it opens up many additional risk factors of being exposed to unsanitary environments, physical trauma, emotional trauma, and then it compounds the problem. At some point, it becomes irrelevant what came first. What's more important is we have severe mental illness and chronic homelessness, unsheltered homelessness occurring together, and they both need to be managed.
They both need to be managed and prevented, right? And Doug, I mean, I wonder, how is this different from the way most mental health care is provided to people who are unhoused in LA? Because it seems like there hasn't been a whole lot of that, but maybe there has been?
Oh, I think what Dr. Rapp does on the street is very different. The person who's living in a tent on the street with severe mental illness doesn't have access to a psychiatric treatment, usually unless they get picked up by law enforcement or some official capacity on what's called a 5150, which is a state statute that allows someone to be detained involuntarily if they are gravely disabled. And that often results in a trip to the emergency room for a 72-hour hold. And because there aren't really enough facilities to hold people for longer after they become immediately stabilized, they're often released back to a shelter. And the process starts over again. So when Dr. Rapp sees somebody on the street, his process is to get them into a stable setting first and use that as a base to figure out what is really the kind of placement they need for the long term.
Well, let me talk to you about that, Dr. Rapp. Walk us through what a typical shift is in dealing with the mental illness that is out there.
Of course. So to give a little bit of background, outreach has existed for quite some time, but the structure of a traditional outreach team is typically a social worker, community worker, possibly a substance use counselor, but it's mostly non-medical staff. The home team is an example of a specialized outreach team that has medical staff, nursing is present, and so is a street psychiatrist. What the home team ends up becoming then is a hub to the many different resources available in the county, but through a field-based team that's walking right to the patient and providing them directly. So what does a typical day look like? The home team at its core is an outreach team. Everything starts with outreach. Finding an individual with severe mental illness who is living on the streets, building a bond with them, building a therapeutic alliance, a relationship of trust, That is difficult to do on the streets, especially if there's a lot of trauma involved. So everything starts with outreach, building a bond with the individual we're trying to help. Once that base, that foundation is built, then the street psychiatrist and the medical staff come in to provide treatment, to provide nursing assessment, medical assessment. And then we start medications if the individual is able to consent to the medications. And then not just giving them a bottle of medications to take on their own. They're living out in the streets and they will likely lose that medication or maybe not use it correctly. We go out daily and provide the medication to the patient, observe them, self-administer the medication with the hope that we can get a safe medication trial taking place. And once that trial is established, if the client will allow us to administer a medication in a long-acting injection, there's a high risk of treatment fallout when somebody's living on the street. But if we can get a long-acting injection off a medication that is clearly indicated for that individual, then we can really start getting some recovery going right off the bat. The whole point of this is so that we can get improvement of mental health symptoms that are so disabling that it's keeping someone from accepting resources. But once those symptoms get better, once the insight gets better, the judgment gets better, we then move an individual quickly into low barrier housing. Once they're off the street and in some sort of a secure place with a roof over their head, we then start more aggressive medications if they're needed, completing lab work if needed, getting them to go see primary care, and then ultimately moving them into long-term housing, which often involves a higher level of barriers as far as medical clearance goes, lab work, and interviews as well. So it's a long, extensive process.
With a caveat, of course, and that is that if the person with mental illness, right, is is allowing you to take care of them or do those things in an outreach way, Doug, some patients with really severe illness wind up being placed under court-ordered conservatorships. We hear about Care Court, right, that the state is implementing through Governor Newsom's program. I mean, How do those kinds of things work into all of this?
Well, the CARES Court is something new that really we don't know yet how it's going to play out. But the conservatorship process, which has existed since the 1960s or late 60s or early 70s, allows a court to determine that a person is gravely disabled and put them under the care of a conservator. And the street team has developed a new way of doing that because, as you can imagine, this is a court process and the person who's going to be conserved has to make appearances in court. And if the person is living on the street, it's a very cumbersome and difficult. You would have to find the person and arrange a hearing date and then get the person to court. But under the new street conservatorship process, Dr. Rabb and his team can actually conduct a court hearing on the sidewalk using a laptop computer and an electronic digital link to the courthouse. So it certainly makes the process more accessible to people living on the street. I should add that this is something that is not the primary method that Dr. Rabb uses. It's a fairly small percentage of the people he works with fall into the category of being service resistant.
This is a last resort option, correct?
It's a last resort option, correct.
So, I mean, because some unhoused advocates are wary of this type of court-ordered treatment. Dr. Rabb, what do you think about that?
You know, it's conservatorship is something that we take very, very seriously because it does involve taking someone's rights away. But at the same time, it also does guarantee some safeties for someone who is unable to really care for themselves, including access to food, clothing, and shelter, without which their life could be in danger. So our whole job is to avoid the need for conservatorship. And if a conservatorship is needed, we're doing it outside of a hospital, outside of the current traditional pathway for conservatorship. Someone can be in the hospital for 6 months waiting for a locked setting. But we have removed that idea of requiring a locked setting because the individual who's being investigated for conservatorship is connected with a basically a street psychiatrist who's a concierge level doctor and works with the patient to keep them in the community with a conservatorship, which basically guarantees that the government will provide, at least public guardian will provide for food, clothing, and shelter for someone who is unable to do so by themselves.
You're one of five psychiatrists, Dr. Rabb, on this street psychiatry team. Doug mentions in his article that there are likely tens of thousands of unhoused people who suffer from mental illness. How do you jibe those things? How do you make a dent, even a dent, in such a, you know, massive, it seems like a massive issue?
It is definitely a very large issue, but big things have small beginnings. Street psychiatry has been practiced in many different states, even in different parts of LA. But what we have done in the Department of Mental Health is integrate street psychiatry in a model that incorporates all the resources we have in the county. Doctors are a large part of our medical and mental health system. And the more education there is about the barriers that are present for this population, the more there will be a synchronized approach into getting these folks along a path of recovery into housing and in safe community living.
Certainly a topic that we could talk about all day long. It's
yes, we could.
It's a giant, giant issue here in LA. Dr. Cheyenne Rabb, psychiatrist with the LA County Department of Mental Health. Doug Smith, a reporter for the LA Times. Thanks to you both for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for us today, but a word about the ability to take a deep dive into what I think is the story of our time here in Greater Los Angeles. The plight of the unhoused affects so many more people than just the unhoused. And being able to wrap our heads and wrap our ears around this issue, looking for answers, demanding answers from politicians, asking for compassion, seeking resolution, it is a prime example of our mission on this radio program and on this podcast at this public radio station. We are LA, just like you are LA. And covering issues important to you is certainly important to us because those issues affect us too. We seek those answers because we live here too. I do. You do. Thank you for your support of public radio in the past. We want the community to thrive. We want you to be informed and enlightened and entertained. On this first day of KCRW's fall fundraiser, go online, show your support so we can keep doing what we do. KCRW.com/give. KCRW.com/give or call 1-800-600-KCRW for a quick contribution. And to make it extra enticing on this first day, there is a special one-day challenge. KCRW board member Norris Bishton and Deborah Bishton want to help us raise $50,000 today and today only by putting 25 grand toward that goal, but you have to step up with the other half. That's a lot of money on the line right now. Donate by midnight tonight at kcrw.com/give. And while you're there, let us know how you're doing. Throw some story ideas at us. Subscribe to the podcast too, kcrw.com. Thank you, thank you, thank you for your support of KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for your ears too, and have a great day.